The creepy, when we talk about three things here, genomic correlations, how different factors of population history affect the stability of haplotype frequencies. And then I'm going to dive into looking at the haplotype structure of fusion genes that are important in the HPV pathway, MDM2 and MDM4. And then I'm combine ideas from the first half of the section and the results of the second part. And that will segue into the stuff in the selection. And this is all going to be in the human population. So, a brief, a very crude first order approximation is that we have a genotype, this may be a particular sequence of letters in DNA, and this has an effect on the phenotype. And we can quantify the phenotype by different measures, for example, age of the plants or those sorts. So, if you're doing statistics, there's two places where you want to measure correlations. One is correlation within the genomic structure. Because we have a variability of the genome in the human population, we have correlations that are induced. And people have been working this for a good part of a century now, and it's been made statistics, and been quantified, and we've got to measure correlation. And obviously, you want to associate your DNA structure with some kind of phenotype. But again, there's a whole zoo of different tests of association. The main talk will be primarily about the first part of the correlation. But I'm going to I want to convince you that just by looking at the correlations amongst alleles, maybe we can say something important about the second type of correlation, even though we aren't measuring any kind of phenotype. Maybe by measuring correlation amongst alleles, we can say something about how this might affect phenotype, even though we have no idea what the phenotype is. And this is like the grand goal of genomics. So let's just dive in to what we mean by variation in DNA sequence. Well, the largest source of variation are single nucleotide polymorphisms. Here's a sequence of letters. Actually, this is extracted from chromosome 17 in human genome. This could be anybody's sequence in this room. And then somebody else will have a slight variation. Instead of a C, they'll have a G at that spot. And so on and so forth. And these are all germline mutations inherited from parents. And the only difference between a mutation and a polymorphism I can gather is that somebody has defined a polymorphism to be 5% prevalent in the population. So until then it's a mutation, then comes polymorphism. And I guess the idea is that they really want to understand how medicine affects the genome. So if you're only dealing with less than 5%, it's not worth it for the biotech companies. So that's why they want to deal with a large sector of the population. I've seen 1%, I've seen 10%. But the HapMap project, that's why. Yeah. It's arbitrary. That's my point. It's completely arbitrary. In fact, this sequence is actually part of a molecule that you've heard today, the p53 gene. So how do we quantify correlation? Well, for historical reasons, they've used... That's the point. There's a variation of sequences, and this is shared by all of us from...
What is shared?
Sorry?
What is shared?
This possible combination of different sequences.
What sequence?
I don't know. You have... There's a... Great.
What does that mean?
Okay, so the whole point of...
We don't care.
I'm going to be slightly more optimistic. I care slightly more. There's a probability distribution of different sequences in the population. And a large part of haplotype analysis is determined the probability distribution of different sequences in the population.
Could this polymorphism also correlate with mutations happening in cancer cells?
So cancer cells, that's a two-part question. These are all germline mutations. And these may give you or may not predisposition to cancer. But once a tumor forms, there are many mutations that occur afterwards. In fact, the mutation rate increases by 1,000-fold. And so those are somatic mutations. But I'm not talking about those mutations. I'm talking about mutations that are present in the entire population due to inheritance from the parents.
Okay,
between these two threats, the very cause of the human population. With one specific selection, each of those points of those morphisms.
No, well, you have two pairs of chromosomes.
With one specific selection at each of those points.
Right.
So in the first point, A chromosome can have C. And that chromosome will also have T in the second point, and so on. So you reduce all of this to a particular selection.
Right, for a person.
A chromosome might have a different selection, and so on, for all different chromosomes
right.
in the population.
And that's what I mean by a haplotype. A haplotype is just a contiguous sequence of these possible forms.
Are there really more polymorphisms in the exon than
introns in the genome? Okay, this is a skewed example. In fact, this isn't quite representative of the whole genome. Usually there's one polymorphism per every 1,000 base pairs.
Yeah.
So if there's 3 billion base pairs, that gives you 3 million polymorphisms. And the HapMap project has genotyped 1 million of those so far. I think the next phase is going to go for the final 3 million. And no. And generally, you expect a polymorphism in a coding part of the region to be deleterious and not be passed on to the next generation. So you're right. Okay. So we measure correlation using this historical notation called linkage disequilibrium. And, you know, on average, you expect strong correlation between two nearby SNPs and reduced correlation between SNPs that are further apart on the human genome. And an interesting part of looking at the correlation structure is that it's an imprint of population history. Many different factors of population history leave an impact on linkage disequilibrium structure. So by deciphering what is the correlation structure, we can say something about the past of the human population. So what are the factors that increase linkage disequilibrium, increase correlation? The first, I guess the most important one, is finite sampling. In any given population, as we pass from one generation to the next generation, what we're effectively doing is resampling chromosomes. Not every chromosome is passed from one generation to the next generation. And so some chromosomes will be lost, and this thereby would induce correlations between SNPs. Another way you'd increase linkage disequilibrium is if you lose a sudden decrease in population. And thereby, you know, you've lost some chromosomes, and this would also increase correlation artificially. Selection. If one particular allele conferred an advantage to producing children, then all those nearby SNPs would travel with that favored allele, and thereby that would increase in frequency in the population. And
what is the density of
polymorphisms
in the units of combination, like, you know, there's some
coordinates
forever.
So once every 1,000 base pairs is the density of SNPs.
And what's the
and recombination? So so the mutation rate that it gives is in the germline is 10 to the minus 8 per generation, and the recombination rate is the same. So there's a 10 to the minus 8 probability that a recombination will occur at a particular loci per generation.
The typical length for a recombination, for you,
right.
The entire history, is a few thousand to a few tens of thousand bases.
I believe the HapMap made that number smaller, much closer to the average distance between base pairs, between SNPs. That was the result of the HapMap that was finalized in 2005. But the point is they're not vastly magnitudes of order different from each other. It's called length scales.
I'm sorry, so what you're calling selection here, that's essentially what I know is genetic
hitchhiking. Yes.
Okay.
Right. A selective sweep that favors one particular allele.
And the area, so the number of SNPs around the favorite allele that are going to be linked will be proportional to the selected.
They will rise with the frequency of the selected allele. In fact, that's entirely my third part of my talk.
Okay.
Right. Immigration, of course, that's going to increase LD. If I move some people from my population, you know, all people with pink hair, then I've reduced the number of chromosomes and I've increased correlation. Decreasing LD, immigration, and the most important way of decreasing correlation is recombination. This is the event in being meiosis when you have switching of genetic material between chromosomes.
Also the age of the population, right? The age of the population is
more chances for recombination. Right, right. No, I'm talking, absolutely. So, but this, this is, when I say recombination, I give you recombination rate per unit time. So as you increase time, you will decrease correlation. And I'll just quantify what Jan said. A very simple example. Suppose we have two loci. Capital A and small a are the two alleles at loci 1. Capital B and small b are the two alleles at loci 2. And we can assign, somehow, if we knew the absolute probabilities of the combination of four different alleles, we can assign, we can give numbers to these four probabilities. So at the next generation, the probability of having the combination of capital A and capital B will depend on the previous frequencies. And it will depend, in a very simplistic way, 1 minus the recombination rate times the previous probability. Obviously, if I have recombination, I'm reducing the probability of that occurring in the next generation. But I can also generate this sequence by recombination events. So it's going to be plus the recombination rate times the probability of A times the probability of B. And you can just derive this in a few lines. So if I want to quantify the correlation, one way of measuring correlation is the mutual information. Mutual information is just a unique way of quantifying how variability is reduced if I know one variable given another variable. And here's just a quick definition of mutual information. So the mutual information at generation time plus 1 is equal to the mutual information between those two alleles at time t times this factor, 1 minus 2c, if I assume c is smaller than 1, which it is, generally. And so after n generations, if n is quite large, the mutual information between any two points in the genome on the same chromosome will decrease exponentially with time.
I'm going to ask the same question again.
Yeah.
Because I didn't understand the answer the first time. So the value of c here depends on the chromosomal difference
between a and b.
C is... What I'm asking is how far do you need to get b from a and C of order 1 as in 0.1.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, you can get that from, I mean, C is defined as the probability of recombination between those two points. But we know the probability of a recombination between two points which are, say, one base pair apart is of the order 10 to the minus 8. It's quite low.
So
there are hot.
Basically, one recombination per chromosome.
One recombination per chromosome per generation.
Per generation. Yeah.
So now this is what I'm asking.
It's
not because you're asking me. The question to be asked is: as you go along the chromosome,
right.
What is the probability? You look at many different versions of that chromosome.
Yes,
what is the probability that two SNPs will be separated by a historical recombination?
It's not the same question.
Not the question.
But it's not the same question.
You know the linkage block size.
Yeah.
You want to know the linkage block size.
Yeah.
But that depends on where you are in the chromosome, how old the population is.
Africans, it's about 8,000 base pairs, and the Caucasians is about
12.
That's exactly what
Kempton
said.
That wasn't the question, though.
But.
yeah, I think you might say it's a mapping, the 1% recombination is
question. But I think I know the answer
now. Okay.
Question.
But let me just add something to that. I mean, this reference to 8,000 base pairs and 12,000 base pairs refers to the definition of haplotype blocks, which is quite arbitrary.
Right.
So I wouldn't take that as a definition of the answer that I think you were trying to pose.
It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it doesn't mean anything, because you can define length scales on it's arbitrary how you define recombination blocks.
No, it doesn't mean anything because it depends on who's mating with whom. It depends on how the chromosomes line up. It really depends on the population that's
taking out the averages.
But the averages are...
But averages are defined.
You can do something with them. This average is meaningless.
Yeah.
I give up.
We can talk about this later. Okay, so, but maybe this helps to help answer some of that question. Recombination doesn't, the correlation doesn't decrease indefinitely. As I said, another factor which increases LD is drift. So you might expect that, you know, the rate of decay of correlation by recombination is cancelled out by the rate of increase of correlation by drift. And the human genome is at some equilibrium point. And if you were to calculate the average mutual information between any two SNPs at distance d apart in a population of n chromosomes, you get this nice cute analytical formula. And this takes actually a couple of pages of algebra to prove. And if you look at here's the chromosome 2. I've taken SNPs on chromosome 2 from the Hadamard project and plotted the average mutual information as a function of distance. In the green line, the gray lines are the gray spots are the actual data points, and the red is the analytical curve. So it's quite a nice fit. Okay, so I can't see any of that actually. It should mean I'm measuring.
The first mark is 50,000. So this
needs an answer. Base pair, yeah. Okay, but it's not but look, this is not exponential decay, so there's no length scale here. It's an algebraic decay. This is why I'm saying there's no such thing as an absolute length scale for recombination. If it was exponential, I would agree. But it's algebraic.
Why do I think I'm correct at zero, not zero?
It seems that, you know, there's some kind of repulsion at small distances. For some reason, I don't know.
But why isn't there a length scale? And you have a distribution, so you can compute the mean and the
variance. No, but I can come up with a length scale, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, you can debate if it's sufficient to give.
Right, but my point is that the way people define length scale is by haplotype blocks, and the way they define haplotype blocks is by pairwise correlation. There's many different ways of defining haplotype blocks. And there's a huge variation in the sizes they give you.
What kind of distribution is there? Does it have a power law thing or?
It's algebraic decay.
Okay, yeah.
That's why there's no length. That's my point. Sorry?
Well, I'm saying n is the population size. This
yeah.
is for humans.
Yeah, this is for humans.
And how large is n?
Okay, I'm going to talk about this. So n, this is a fit. So n has to be inferred from the data. And this model assumes a constant n. Which is obviously a bad generalization for humans. There's obviously been huge population growth. But we can ask the question, what's the average population, what's the average mutual information if n was allowed to vary with time? So and what we get is the same formula, but now we have an effective n, where 1/1 the effective n is given by the reciprocal, sum of reciprocals of 1/1 the different population sizes. And the important point to note is that this term is going to be completely dominated when one of these is quite small. So this is how population bottleneck affects linkage disequilibrium in the human genome. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So
probably makes it divided by t, the rate of fact divided by t.
No.
Is it no?
Yeah, yes.
No.
Because it accumulates, the block sizes keep going smaller and smaller.
If n is constant, you want to have.
For example. Yeah, the population of different sizes. I'm assuming a very simplistic model. Time equals 1, I have a certain population size, n1. And then everybody dies, there's a whole new second set of people in the population. A very crude approximation. But it gives you, but the point is, you shouldn't take it too seriously. It gives you a qualitative understanding of how a population bottleneck will affect linkage disequilibrium.
If only n constant, then n b should be equal to n1 and n2. You have to divide.
Yeah, you're right. It has to be normalized, right? Right. Okay. Okay, so those are some of the ideas of correlations in the human genome. And so we look at the haplotype structure of two important oncogenes in the P53 pathway. Arnie mentioned briefly MDM2. And there's also another molecule, protein, MDM4. And they're both oncogenes, meaning a high expression of these genes is likely to give you a higher predisposition to getting cancer at an earlier age. And in fact, elevated levels of MDM2 are found in 7% of all cancers, independent of P53 status. And the way they are connected to P53 is by this simple diagram. You have some kind of stress, which Arnie described earlier in detail. This will, through various intermediates, increase levels of MDM2 and MDM4. There's crosstalk between these two proteins. This is determined by biochemistry. And then they both inhibit P53. And increased levels of P53 leads to these different final phenotypes. I think the way MDM2 was, the function of MDM2 was discovered, it was in mouse genetics, where they knocked out MDM2 in mice, and what they found was that the embryo in the MDM2 knocked out mother wasn't able to develop fully. What happened was, because an embryo is developing in a very hypoxic, stressed condition, it increases the levels of P53, because there's no inhibitory feedback for MDM2, and this causes cell apoptosis of the fetus, so there's no fetus being resolved. So the way I got interested in this was work done by Arnie's lab before I joined, and they found a functional SNP, which is, I guess, not that common in human genome thus far, in the promoter region of MDM2. And the derived ancestral form is the T allele, and you can determine the ancestral form by looking at a chimpanzee. And the mutant form is the G allele. And what they were able to find is that there's a strong association with the age of onset of cancer. And here's a diagram I just stole from one of the papers, that having a GG or a TG form induces, on average, an earlier age of onset of cancer, breast cancer in this case. And the mechanism by which they think this happens is, well, in the normal form, you have the TT in the promoter region, and the promoter, when activated, induces MDM2, and this inhibits P53, and you have reduced response to stress. If you have a GG form here, this increases the affinity to a transcription factor called SP1. So this increases levels of MDM2, and therefore causes a greater inhibition of P53, and therefore there's a reduced response to stress. And that's why a GG form would likely to give you a deleterious phenotype in terms of age of onset of cancer. So let's describe the study that we performed. We obtained genotypes from two different data sets. The first was obtained by Select Diagnostics, 11 SNPs genotyped across MDM2. 91 cell lines were genotyped, 53 of those were African American, 38 Caucasian, and we did this for MDM2 and MDM4. The second set were 6 SNPs around the SNP 309 from 139 Ashkenazi Jewish females. This is actually a subsample of a much larger study of 553 patients, but most of those were patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations and had cancer. So to prevent ascertainment bias, we just used the control sample, which is 139 patients. And here's the MDM2 gene in its glory. This just shows the SNPs that were genotyped. The top line of the SNPs genotyped by Celero Diagnostics. It's a pretty large gene, 32,000 base pairs. SNP 309 is in the first intron, the promoter region, and SNP 309 was actually genotyped by both studies. So we actually have 3 common SNPs to both studies. So in total, we have 14 different possible SNPs. So the first thing you want to do is, once you obtain genotypes, you want to infer the haplotypes. And that's a tricky business because, you know, the haplotypes are ambiguous given the genotypes. So there's been many algorithms developed, and like many problems in computer science. Some first developed a very simplistic program called based on maximum parsimony. And then years later, someone has a great idea of using maximum likelihood. And finally, someone has a great idea of why don't we use a Bayesian formulation. And this is exactly what's happened in this field. So the state-of-the-art way of haplotyping is using a Bayesian inference program. And here I've plotted the haplotypes, the inferred haplotypes. And the way I've plotted this is in a very SNP309-centric way. So if I go back, I'm going to be showing these 11 SNPs. On the top line, I'm going to be showing the inferred frequency of SNP309. The second line, I'll be showing the two adjacent SNPs and SNP309, and so on and so forth, until I've covered all 11 SNPs all the way down. So this is the data for the African-American population. The salient point to notice is that, you know, the T allele occurs in 90% of the population, and there's a great variety of associated haplotypes with the T allele. This is what you expected. And the G allele has only occurs in 10% of the population, and it's only one haplotype. There's a very strong correlation of the G allele with the other alleles. In contrast to Caucasian.
Do you have results for the Africans in Africa?
I'd love to. That really needs to be determined. And I'll say why, because if you look at this G allele in Caucasian, this haplotype is exactly the same as the haplotype in the African American. So it suggests that this Caucasian, this haplotype, occurred due to admixture in the African American population.
I'm having trouble just understanding this. The T at the top is SNP309.
Yep.
And what are the things on the next line there?
Okay, so CTT is one possible combination of these three SNPs. I've added two adjacent SNPs around SNP309.
Okay.
And the next line, I've got five SNPs, and the following line I've added these two SNPs, and every time I'm adding two more SNPs. Mm-hmm. But the SNP309 should always be obvious in red in each line.
The numbers in the bottom row and up to 100?
Should do. That's a good point. I've got a very small sample size, and this is an endemic problem in the field. And if I'm trying to infer population frequencies from a very small sample size, you can infer what is the variance. And this is a multinomial sampling problem. And so it's very hard to trust anything which has a frequency of less than 2%. So I've ignored those haplotypes which have a frequency.
It's an actual data.
No. This is inferred haplotypes.
Genotypes
are. It's inferred haplotypes from the genotypes.
By an algorithm.
By an algorithm.
From the data. By an algorithm.
Yeah. I mean, you can determine haplotypes experimentally, but that's extremely expensive, and that's why there's been a huge industry developed in developing these algorithms. What I want you to notice is that you would expect a large associated number of allele of haplotypes with the T allele because it has such a large frequency. But yet in the Caucasians, it's the G allele, it's still quite large, 43%, and yet there's only one haplotype across the whole genome of the MDM2 gene. There's a very strong correlation with the G allele with the other SNPs.
Coming from the SNP309 is always covering with the K.
Yep.
And the right. So this SNP, there was like a combination there in the middle of
it? Well, we think those two SNPs occurred at the same time. In a small, on the same background, in a small window of time. It seems, I thought it's improbable, but apparently this occurs quite commonly in human genome.
If you overlay the African part of this curve on the old curve, is there something you can learn in the real Africans that the number of haplotypes should be greater than the number of haplotypes?
Sure, and that's exactly what we see. I mean, we see that the variability of the T allele haplotypes in African Americans is much greater than the variability. And these are subsets of the African haplotypes.
Yeah, but they should also appear after a certain time has elapsed. So, in fact, all the ones that you see here should be lower in the tree than some cutoff time.
Right,
on the
but, yeah, you're right. But there's a problem with doing that because there's no obvious precursor of this gelial in the Africans. So, yeah.
So how do you get those numbers? You're counting the data.
I am inferring the haplotype frequencies from the genotype data.
So what is the assumption that you're inferring?
So there's only one assumption that's implicit, that I assume Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. And that's only going to be true within each ethnic population.
Yes.
And you can check the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium from just genotype data to see if you're violating that assumption or not. And once you accept it is a Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, you can then haplotype with some confidence. And so people have done simulations and they've shown that the haplotype inference matches pretty well, actually.
The Hardy-Weinberg does not work with selection.
There's going to be some deviation.
Cool,
yeah. For very strong selection. Yeah. You're right.
I'm trying to understand this. So, are you saying that the G allele is a relatively new mutation that appeared on that chromosome in the Caucasian population? That
right.
explains your data?
That's. You've said my next piece, yeah. Yeah.
But how could it appear in Asian and Caucasian and have such strong linkages? I would have expected something that was so old to be before the races dispersed to have more linkage disequilibrium.
Right. But the hypothesis that I would work with was that this occurred during the first initial wave of migration out of Africa. That formed the...
And a new mutation that appeared before the races dispersed
right.
could still show that
yes.
anomaly linkage disequilibrium.
Okay,
right.
Especially if it's selected for.
Right.
Okay. That's, you're moving in that direction because you're asking
the right question. Okay, I have one more. The sequence that you see around the G allele,
mm-hmm.
is that present in one of the African sequences?
This is identical to African.
No. Is there a corresponding haplotype?
That is also present in
the other than the G, is there a corresponding haplotype?
Yes, there is, yeah.
And can you tell what Africans those are, from where? Because the Europeans are known to have descended from a particular sublineage of Africans, the L3.
Right, no, I haven't done that analysis yet. But that would be interesting, actually.
But they would be connected. I mean, if they are a breeding pool, then it would be the same set. It's the San people, you know.
And for the Ashkenazi Jewish study, where we had just 6 NIPs, here we have a more extreme case of the pattern that I've been describing. The telial has only 47% prevalence in the population, and the gelial has a greater frequency, but still has reduced variability in the population. So this strikes us as being odd, as being abnormal. But first we have to define what normal is before we say this is abnormal. Yeah. 10 in the Africans. And this is actually similar to the frequency that we observe in the Asian population as well. This I find
useful to say this particular frequency is such a different thing that is a power. It's well known that the Ashkenazi Jewish population at the bottom that they used to live. A small number of people making contributions to a large number of people to the Ashkenazi Jews.
actually derived measurement of the frequency. It's lack that is being applied selected by higher level by chance.
And all I was suggesting is that there's a second explanation in the archaeology group, and that is that they had a bottleneck in Eastern Europe 1,000 years ago. And that the full number of Ashkenazi Jews came to Eastern Europe, and they are the ancestors of the Ashkenazi Jewish population. So there, you can't make the same argument of Asians and Caucasians, because there was a bottleneck, there's an awful lot of diversity
right
there. But that's not true for the Ashkenazi Jewish population.
But couldn't you separate the Ashkenazi Jews that have that bottleneck, or went through the bottleneck, from normal Caucasians by looking at haplotypes? Which appear with certain frequencies in the two sets separately, right? Compare yeah them to each other. You should be able to tell.
Yeah, I'm sure you could, but I find it still strange following the discussion why the Asians would have the same frequency as the Ashkenazi Jewish population. I mean, I don't think the Asians went through the same bottleneck effect. Yeah. Right. But you know, the general trend is that you know the Africans and the African Americans have a very low frequency, and it's probably due to ag mixture. It probably isn't there if you were to go to Africa, a true African
site.
It's at a 3% frequency in Nigeria, for example, and that could still be due to admixture because there's been a couple hundred years of
colonial history.
French people in Nigeria. So it keeps going down every time you get closer to Africa.
So you had a hypothesis that had to do with the mean with starvation. That the hypothesis went down
having an effect on that. Well, sure, starvation is having an effect on lots of alleles, but I don't know. I'm going to suggest that it's
different.
So how do you decide which is the structure? Suppose you structure the neighbor and you work for the same thing?
Yep. And that, in fact, that's what I do for the other SNPs in my following discussion. This is very SNP-tier 9 centric. This is very biased, this description of the alleles. Mm-hmm. But I'll, in the following discussion, I'll show how I did the sim analysis for all the other alleles, and I compared this one with those.
But at the end of the day, you assign numbers to
prototypes. Yep.
You arrive at the same numbers?
Yes. Yes.
The symmetry is broken, but the complete SNP is the one in correct place.
Right. But we didn't have to know that beforehand. Right. It just so happened that that is how we got started on this project. So usually when you look at a population genetics paper, they want to publish, after they publish the haplotypes, they want to publish the linkage distribution results. And these are two measures. It's not important what these two measures actually mean. The important point is that SNP 209, which is the fourth one in this Ashkenazi Jewish data set, it's a heat map from 0 to 1. SNP 309 travels, it's strongly correlated with the sixth SNP in the study. And we can do the same thing for Caucasians and African Americans. And we find that SNP 309 actually travels with the same SNP and another one, because we have a larger study in the Celera data set. Color here is a heat map of correlation, yeah, as I go from 0 to 1. We did the same thing for MDM4, where we had the Caucasians and African Americans, we genotyped them, and here's the tree structure for the haplotypes in the African Americans. Nothing particularly odd. This is what you expect. You expect a high frequency SNP to have many associated haplotypes, and a low frequency SNP to have a reduced variability. However, if you go to Caucasian, what you find is particularly striking. This haplotype is the only one of its kind with respect to the first two SNPs, and yet it occurs in 67% of the population, whereas the reduced frequency haplotype of the first two SNPs has a much greater associated variability. So this got us thinking that maybe there's some kind of perturbation away from the neutral assumptions, that maybe there's some kind of selection pressure in this part of the genome. So this is actually the third part of my talk. usually when you think of a natural selection in the human genome, you usually have some biological phenotype. And that's, and then you go to the genome and then you infer where exactly in the genome do you have this mutation occurring, which gives you increased frequency. For example, in 1941, it was noticed that the prevalence of sickle cell anemia is in geographical area where people are resistant to malaria. And this led to the hypothesis that maybe there's a mutation in the hemoglobin B gene. And this is how people were able to locate the part of the genome that was being selected for. And same again for the Duffy antigen gene, which is actually prevents infiltration by the P. vivax malaria. And the lactase gene. 12,000 years ago, when the humans moved from a hunter-gatherer society to a society that was more agrarian and domesticated cattle, it became more advantageous to be able to tolerate lactose as an adult. And so it was hypothesized that there was some kind of selection pressure to tolerate lactose in the human population. So if you go to Africa, you wouldn't find this mutation, whereas in the rest of the world, this has increased in frequency quite rapidly. So this is the past. Now, we had some phenotype and we had some association with the genome. But in this post-haplotype, hapmap world, the goal, idealistic goal, would be to infer selection from the linkage dislocation structure without knowing any phenotype. Can we do that? Just by looking at the association of alleles in the hapmap project, can we infer a kind of positive selection in the human genome? So we're not the first people to try and do infer selection. The only thing I want to say about these previous tests is that they make the assumption that the alleles are independent, that there's zero correlation between the alleles. So they completely ignore haplotype structure. So there's a big loss of power in these statistics. And you'd expect a strong selection pressure would have a strong effect, as we've seen, that it may have a strong effect on haplotype structure. So can we devise a test that incorporates haplotype correlation? So here's the observation which guides us. High-frequency alleles are typically older. They've been in the population for a greater number of generations and have reduced associations with nearby alleles because they've had more time to recombine with nearby SNPs. Low-frequency alleles are typically younger and therefore you expect them to have high linkage disequilibrium. They're going to be much more strongly correlated with nearby SNPs because they've had less time to recombine and reduce the correlations with nearby SNPs. So using this observation, we can devise a statistic which is sensitive to deviations from these assumptions. So the first thing we have to do is define what we mean by associations and haplotypes. And so one sensible measure to measure haplotype diversity is the multi-entropy. Multi-entropy system has many mathematical advantages. The most obvious one related to this study is that it goes more than just pairwise correlations, whereas the previous pairwise measures are, deal with two at a time. Well, this considers correlations for arbitrary number of SNPs at a time. And if all those SNPs were independent, the total entropy will be sum of the individual entropies. And so by taking the difference between those two terms, you can define some kind of multi-information, a multi-correlation term between those two. So just to test this idea, what I did was I generated a multi-correlated simulation of chromosomes, where I tried to match the mutation rate and recombination rate, something similar to human genome. It doesn't matter how similar it has to be. And then I took 1,000 samples from this multicolor sample. And then I took a particular allele somewhere along this sequence of chromosomes. And this allele had a 81% frequency, and the minor allele had 19% frequency. And then what I did was I measured the associated entropy, and entropy is a measure of variability, as I increased distance away from my central allele at site equal zero. And so under a neutral evolution, this is what you expect. As I increase distance away from my central allele, the high frequency allele would have a much greater associated entropy than a low frequency allele. And just as a sanity check, I went to a different site where the two alleles had similar frequencies, and the rise in curve overlaps with each other. So this difference in curves could be used as a statistic for neutral evolution. If I have a large frequency allele that's evolving neutrally, there should be a large increase. There should be a large difference in curves. If I have a low frequency allele, there should be a large negative difference in the curves. And 50%, there should be almost close to zero difference in the area under the curves. So if I then plot the data for all these data points in the Monte Carlo simulation of 250,000 base pairs, that's over 7,000 SNPs, this is the graph I get. So the DLE is the differential linkage equilibrium. This is the difference in curves plot against the frequency allele. And this is what you expect. A high frequency allele has, on average, a large positive difference in the area of curves. A 50% allele is roughly zero, and a low frequency allele is roughly negative.
This is real data, or is this
simulated Monte Carlo data? This is just to prove that, you know.
So you're not yet trying to predict function based on this.
No.
It's all Monte Carlo.
Okay. This is a set of 1,000 chromosomes which are all evolving neutrally. There's no selection pressure on any of those alleles.
Selection pressure will somehow perturb this.
Yes. Okay. So I can then do exactly that. I can generate another Monte Carlo simulation where I artificially say I have one allele which has a 5% advantage of going into the next generation above and beyond all the other alleles. And what does that curve look? What does that graph look like? Well, I get the same relationship, but my particular allele deviates from the other alleles for that particular frequency. So this could be used as a statistic to show a deviation from neutrality behavior. Yeah.
So if you give me 1,000 of the connected ones, or repeat it many times.
This is unfortunate. You're right. It has a large variance. So the way we assign statistical significance is we have a neutral model, and then we ask what's the probability of getting this value given the neutral model. Yeah. So we have to assign a p-value under the null hypothesis of there being no selection for that particular frequency.
Distribution connected to
its
population size?
So the width, there's many stochastic events here, right? Recombination occurs stochastically. I have an average recombination rate across the whole genome. So recombination can occur anywhere with some random probability. I also have a random mutation rate. So I also have a variability in distances between SNPs. So this just reflects these, and I have also finite sampling from one generation to another generation. So all those different levels of noise sum up to give you this variation.
But you cannot estimate based on some model of neutral evolution what the width of that would be.
Analytically, it's very hard. Yes.
Why do you think the one with such a high density at the
end? Well, because
lots of things that are approaching fixation and lots.
Fixation, yes.
I don't know fixation or aborting.
Or deleting.
So
you
actually
simulate
the chromosome.
Right.
And the red dot is what would happen to this 5% selected allele in Monte Carlo simulations?
This is it.
Right. I'm just trying to figure. So how would you use this in the one human population that exists? I mean, you're going to look at the haplotype. Maybe you'll say this. But
right.
You get the haplotype map of the human, of the human. And you can't Monte Carlo simulate that. So how will you calculate, can you calculate DLE from?
So my only input into this neutral model is the
mutation rate
and recombination rate. And that I can infer from real data. So I can go to the human genome, the HapMap project, extract what's the recombination rate and mutation rate, and generate what I would expect the human genome DLE to look like if there was no selection anywhere. And if there is selection, there'll be deviation from this behavior. That's a, yeah. Right. Yeah. Ideally, I would like to incorporate a heterogeneous recombination. But for now, that's a gross simplification.
So something that has just a few polymorphisms and large haplotype block would be evidence for selection in the human genome.
Something which has a large haplotype block. Yeah, and a high frequency. That's the whole point. It's been pushed up to a high frequency right. In such a short time. It hasn't had time to reduce the block size. Block. Yeah,
and not too many other polymorphisms at all because there's been some adaptive speed.
Right, exactly.
Is evidence for a gene that's under positive selection in a human population?
I propose.
Right.
Yes. But that's not going to be a problem for MDM2 and MDM4 gene because it's relatively small, so I can assume a constant recombination rate. But in general, if I had to do this for the whole genome, I would have to incorporate a heterogeneous recombination rate. You're right.
So just to be clear, to generate this, the null, you need an estimated recombination rate, mutation rate, and
population size. No, No, you're right. But to make comparisons, I take a subsample. That's the same as my sample in my empirical study. That's the only way I can make comparisons. But you're right. No, I take it back. You do have to assume a finite number of chromosomes to incorporate drift. Yeah.
In a very young population.
Yeah.
Right, you would mistake every allele.
Yeah. You have to let it evolve for a sufficient large number of times.
Yes.
Right. Definitely let it evolve. And eventually, if it let it evolve for too long, what will happen is that this will get fixated, and then it won't be a polymorphism anymore.
Does selection happen on such long timescales?
Yeah.
For the kind of selection you're talking about?
No. This is going to be sensitive to recent selection. And this is the kind of... the reason why we developed this is because we think there's recent selection in the haplotype structure of MDM2 and MDM4.
And what does recent selection mean? Is that within a race, between races, down to primates, down to mice? What is recent selection?
Just as a rough... 30
years.
30? Yeah, as a rough order of magnitude, a couple of 10,000 years, you would not see the selection pressure. Yeah.
Is that race, what is 10,000 years?
Is that European scheme out of reference?
Yeah,
okay.
Well, we know from the HapMap project it's not constant across the whole genome.
If one is taking the things that they have no coding agreements,
yes.
And trying to do these things.
But you're assuming that there's no selection in the non-coding, right? Yeah, you're assuming that, right? But there may be. I don't know. That'd be very interesting, actually, a project to do this for the entire human genome and see if there's actually selection pressure within the non-coding parts of the genome. The deviation is a function of the selection pressure.
So given selection pressure.
Yeah.
And it can introduce in a genuinely start from the left.
Yep.
And it should go to the right.
Right.
And now I'm trying to think about the y axis.
Yeah.
It starts within the cloud, right? And it would end up within the cloud as well.
I mean eventually. No, I mean. There will still be a deviation, and it will just disappear off its axis once it fixates. but it will project at a lower than the crowd. Because it's still, I mean, the idea is that it's still being favored even at that high frequency.
But it puts nothing inside the crowd, no?
Right.
But how come it should also go back there?
So right.
Time goes on and you hit more
dimensions. Right. No, but you're assuming that you know it's sweeping so quickly that you know there isn't much. It sweeps.
But this is the short
time. Yeah. That there isn't that much time to reduce the habitype block by time it fixates.
Anyway, you could reach frequency of one.
What is problematic with respect to the size of the cloud, I think what you're saying is that the, probably the size of the signal of the cloud is proportional to the rate times time or something like that.
The width of the cloud?
Yeah.
Well, it's a function of different stochastic events.
Yeah, but I mean, it should be proportional to the rate of recombination.
Yes, yeah.
If one is zero, the other is zero, then you then with time, this cloud is going to be smaller. It's going to be the size of the signal.
No, but yes, you have new mutations occurring all the time.
Yes. Data, you're including new mutations.
Mutation, yeah. That's an input into my data, into my Monte Carlo simulation, mutation rate and recombination rate.
I think I made that before, but if you put the same data and you add
It's hard to tell because that could just be a new allele, right? A new allele wouldn't have enough time to, you know, reduce the haplotype length, and would still have a low frequency. So you can't tell from something that's been pushed from high to low. From an allele, that's a problem. So I can check it's positive selection.
So could you during the discussion, since this thing is moving to the right over time, if you did this in real data, you would stratify selective alleles by when they happen? By just when they appear on the
How would I get real data? I'd love to have real data of the human genome over time.
No, if you did in your simulation.
Right.
You introduce it at different times.
Right, I see what you're saying, right.
Then would you fill up the bottom half of this with red dots, and where the red dot would appear, and would start to drift to the right over time? So you could actually stratify the frequency by when the allele appeared. It means you can tell when the selection happened.
Yeah, but it's going to be on average, right? Because, you know, the allele frequency can go up and down with some probability. On average, there's a drift to the right, but it's a Brownian motion kind of random walk towards the right. But yeah, on average, I can find the age of an allele. You're right.
Okay, so what would happen if you would include two of these selected alleles and they would start to interact in population?
That's an interesting question. I mean, if they're independent, there will be
they
two independent.
Might block each other out, and there might be just one goes through. And
right, but this is looking at a single allele at a time. Yeah, so that would be different.
But do they have that example in Indian 2 and Indian 4?
I do, but they're on different chromosomes.
Yes, but proteins interact.
Right, but we would have to genotype on the same cell lines for us to infer that. We can do this by separate in studies.
I think, so based on the neutral theory, you can easily calculate how old a neutral mutation is, but without a measure, without an estimate of the strength of selection on that selectivity, you can't estimate
the neutral. Yeah, you assume all selections,
but you can actually do slightly better. You can actually infer the selection coefficient from this.
Yes, but you can't.
From a simulation.
But you can't estimate both how old the mutation is and the selection coefficient.
I mean, it's right. You have to fix one to turn the other. Right.
You can calculate selection relative to mutual evolution.
Right.
You can't calculate the relative selective pressure on two different alleles.
Right.
It's true.
So if we do this for the MDM2 and MDM4 gene, we do find a significant deviation. In fact, the probabilities created from multiple hypothesis testing is of the order of 4% and 1% for the different races. One caveat, and this is something that Bowles harped on, is that you have to make an assessment of the estimated recombination rate. And right as of now, this is still more of an art form than a science form of estimating recombination rate. There's a huge confidence interval in estimating recombination rates. And there's many algorithms out there that are dedicated to this, and it's still an ongoing research. So this begs selection. Why do we have selection of the G allele? You remember, the G allele is the deleterious one. It gives you, on average, 15 years earlier age of onset of cancer and breast cancer in the data set that I showed you. So one possible suggestion, and this is just a hypothesis, is the observation that there's another SNP in the p53 pathway, actually on the p53 gene, which converts an arginine form to a proline form. Right? Proline to an arginine form from the equator to the North Pole. And the arginine form gives you overexpression of p53. So the prevalence of the G allele haplotype in MDM2, as you increase distance away from the equator, somehow downregulates the increase of p53. So what happens is somehow the p53 levels are being regulated at some level in the human population. And so this goes back to the idea of, you want to live life in moderation, where too much p53 is going to be bad for you, and too little p53 is also bad for you. In fact, there's been studies in mice where they've shown that increasing p53 activity, actually a recent study in 2002, suppresses the development of cancer mice, but also promotes the premature development of aging phenotypes. The mouse looks older, it wears away, it starts walking slowly, and it dies younger. A related tumor suppressor, p16, has recently been reported to also accelerate aging, and also the age of onset of diabetes, and that's not too surprising given the discussion earlier today. So there seems to be a magic window in which p53 has to operate, and so there's been a natural selection operating on the inhibitors of p53 to maintain these levels. And just want to acknowledge the real biologists at the Institute of Advanced Study. Gareth and Elizabeth did some of the genotyping in Arnie's group. Celera Diagnostics provided the genotype data for the lymphoblastoid cell lines. And the Sheba Medical Center provided the genotypes for the Ashkenazi Jewish population in Israel. That's it. That's the next question, which we're trying to ascertain whether if we look at the same cell lines, is there a direct correlation between those two polymorphisms? So we have to genotype the same cell lines for 53 and MDM2.
In that, you see proline very high, and you see
T. Can you see the proline? What
gene
is
going? No, this is a
p53. Two different genes. Historically, out of Africa on the equator, it's monolithic. And as you go north or south, there's a geographic climb where arginine is found more often and where G is found more often. So there, one of the reasons Gibson suspected all along that the conclusion of think you might be right is there's geographic distributions which are different
So it's monotonically increasing the prevalence of arginine as you go away from the equator, and same with the SNP309.
Even Eskimos should have a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if you guys try Eskimos, but Scandinavians but very high alginine, and they are they're the Caucasian group that has 38%.
But
that's always a big problem. I mean, geography implies, especially before the 20th century, no mobility. And I mean, that's a big problem in genetics.
Yeah, the good thing is this way of structuring the political structure first and then doing the correlation with the data.
Data sets that you can use? I mean, how much of a human genome is positive selection?
That's a very good question. I mean, that's potentially all.
Do you have any estimates? Is it like 1 out of 1,000 genes or 10% of all genes?
Okay, so different parts of that question. This possibly mean a large part of the human genome that's been subject to positive selection. This statistic only detects recent selection in human evolution. So it won't be sensitive to selection that's, you know, been beneficial to humans diverging away from its primate ancestors. So it would depend on the statistic I'm using.
You put the data on it. So you've done this for the three genes you gave examples for, sickle cell,
right?
Which would be malaria in Africa, right. Positively selected for, I don't know how many years. But the other one, lactase gene is 5,000 years old for selection, because it's domestication of animals and adults drinking milk with the selection on, that's usually put in about 5,000
years. But Asians don't have this, right? So what happened to Asians? We didn't develop the mutation?
We did domesticate,
but that actually gives you a time and meaning, right? 10,000 years is when the split happened, and it appeared in Europeans and didn't appear in Asians.
Is that because
Asians don't have
milk?
No, in spite of the fact we have milk, we get gas and you don't. That's
not true. I like milk.
Oh, but you must have a European ancestor or something.
But you know that everyone has Genghis Khan as their ancestor.
Right.
So, but the point isn't really how old the mutation is. The point is whether or not the population is polymorphic. So it's a test that's based on.
It's explicitly based on the signal nucleotide polymorphisms.
Right.
Absolutely.
So by definition, it could be a stable polymorphism that's existed for tens of thousands of years.
Absolutely, right.
And we'd still be able to use this test.
Yeah.
As soon as it could be a 100-year-old mutation that's got fixation.
Which seems unlikely in a human population, 100 years. I mean.
Another question I have is, selection doesn't necessarily have to have a new mutation that appeared, right? Selection could just be a subdominant population that is.
No, absolutely, that moves to a new environment,
long time ago,
right?
And then you got selected.
Absolutely.
Because I'm changing.
Yeah. Environment. So, but this would not pick that up. This is a limitation. So, if there's already an allele which occurs at a pretty large frequency, and suddenly this population which has this allele moves to a different environment where it's conducive to have this allele, I would lose power to pick it up. You're right. Because the haplotype block would already be quite diminished. So this
small blocks,
yeah.
And then you were sending amplification of some small allele,
right.
Some ancient allele.
That wouldn't be a selective sweep then. I mean, it'd be too short a time. We'd probably fixate too quickly to pick it up.
Okay, so thank you very much.